KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS Falls Pass.
Good morning. Elon Musk held up a chainsaw at a political conference celebrating his promise to cut spending. He's also a government contractor. How much can he influence spending on his companies? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. A Ukrainian pacifist decided that even he should volunteer to defend against Russia's invasion. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. The man was captured, and now that he's free, he tells us in this hour what he has learned from his experience. Also, the U.S. Foreign Aid Agency predicted famine around the world. What's it mean that that system has gone dark? And StoryCorps hears from the widow of the activist and comedian Dick Gregory. It's Friday, February 21st. This day in 1958, the British Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament chose a logo, now known as the peace symbol. News is next. Peace out.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is praising his meeting this week with the Trump administration's special envoy for Ukraine and Russia. He says this restores hope. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from Kyiv. President Trump has been attacking Zelensky.
In a video address, Zelensky praised the Trump envoy, Keith Kellogg, and said Ukraine needs strong agreements with the U.S. We discussed the need for a reliable system of security guarantees so the war does not return and the Russians do not destroy more lives, Zelensky said. We all need peace. Ukraine, Europe, America, the whole world. Zelensky said he and Kellogg also talked about a deal that would give the U.S. control over some of Ukraine's mineral rights in exchange for continued military aid. Earlier this week, Trump repeated Kremlin talking points attacking Ukraine and Zelensky lamented that Trump was living in, quote, a space of disinformation. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
The Senate has passed a budget resolution that would advance President Trump's political goals. The Senate was in session all night before adopting the measure, mostly on party lines. It calls for billions of dollars in new military spending as well as for border security. What's not clear is how Republicans intend to pay for these efforts. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer says middle-class Americans might be forced to cover the costs.
This debate is going to go on for weeks and maybe months. Democrats will be ready to come back and do this over and over again because Americans deserve to know the truth. And what is the truth? Under Donald Trump's Republican Party, billionaires win and American families lose.
The Senate is expected to put Trump's agenda items in more than one bill, but Trump does not like what the Senate is doing. He prefers the House version. House lawmakers are trying to shoehorn Trump's priorities into a single bill. Stocks opened lower this morning as the National Association of Realtors reported a slowdown in home sales last month. NPR Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average tumbled about 380 points in early trading.
Sales of existing homes fell nearly 5% in January compared to the previous month. The average sales price was just under $397,000. High prices and high mortgage rates have been a drag on the housing market. Freddie Mac says the average rate on a 30-year fixed home loan is now 6.85%. Mortgage rates have barely budged in the last month. Meanwhile, the number of homes on the market has increased. Stock in United Health Group is down this morning after a report that federal investigators are scrutinizing the company's billing practices. The Wall Street Journal says the Justice Department is investigating the way United Health bills the federal government for people on its Medicare Advantage plans. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is now down 380 points. This is NPR. Authorities in Israel say one of the bodies handed over by Hamas yesterday as part of the ceasefire agreement is not the body of a hostage. The body of Shiri Bibas was supposed to be handed over yesterday. The bodies of her two young sons were positively identified, as was that of a fourth hostage. Israel's military says this development is a violation of the utmost severity by Hamas. Tomorrow, Hamas is supposed to free six living hostages. President Trump's advisor overseeing firings of thousands of federal workers through the DOGE entity has been celebrated. Billionaire Elon Musk appeared at an annual gathering of political conservatives outside Washington. It's known as CPAC. NPR's Stephen Fowler reports.
After Musk took the CPAC stage, Argentina's President Javier Milei brought him a chainsaw to symbolize his work to slash the size, scope, and spending of the U.S. government. Musk hyped the idea of taking some of that savings identified by Doge and giving it back to taxpayers.
It's money that's taken away from things that are destructive to the country and from organizations that hate you.
But that idea is a long way from coming to fruition. An NPR review finds the Doge effort has overstated its savings claims so far by billions of dollars. Stephen Fowler, NPR News, Washington.
The NBA star Victor Wembanyama is out for the rest of the season. The San Antonio Spurs disclosed yesterday he has a blood clot deep in his shoulder. Experts warn in some cases such clots can lead to heart and lung problems. The Spurs say they're optimistic he'll make a full recovery. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm A. Martinez.
I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. In a few minutes, we'll bring you the story of a Ukrainian pacifist who felt he had to put those principles aside to defend his country. But first, members of Elon Musk's Doge team are continuing their march through government agencies on what they say is a mission to find fraud and wasteful spending. Musk himself is often seen at President Trump's side, who praises him frequently.
And Elon Musk has done an amazing job, I have to tell you. Him and his super geniuses, you know, these are seriously high IQ people.
Musk is classified as a special government employee. That's a role created by Congress in the 1960s that allows parts of the federal government to bring someone on for a specific role on a temporary basis. He is also a tech billionaire. And as NPR senior White House correspondent Tamara Keith reports, the line between those roles is blurry.
We've got one more surprise in case this wasn't enough. I'm going to let Elon do it.
Elon Musk was a surprise guest at the Conservative Political Action Conference outside of Washington, D.C. yesterday. And as part of his introduction, the president of Argentina walked out on stage to give him a red and chrome chainsaw.
President Milei has a gift for me.
Musk waved it excitedly.
This is the chainsaw for bureaucracy. Chainsaw!
Taking a chainsaw to bureaucracy is what Musk claims to be doing with his project known as the Department of Government Efficiency. But last week, when he met with Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, it wasn't initially clear whether he was there as a member of the Trump administration or as the CEO of Tesla, which is looking to expand in India.
Breaking news coming in. We're getting a reaction from Prime Minister Narendra Modi after his meeting with Elon Musk. He's taken to social media platform X to say it was a delight to meet.
Presenters on India Today speculated about whether they had discussed Tesla or Doge. A White House official says Musk met with Modi in his personal capacity. Later, though, he was in the Oval Office for Trump's meeting with Modi. In frequent posts on his social media site X, Musk ping-pongs between talking about his work slashing government and promoting his business ventures, many of which have government contracts or are regulated by federal agencies. But Trump and Musk dismissed concerns about possible conflicts of interest in a Fox News interview with Sean Hannity.
I mean, I haven't asked the president for anything ever.
And it's if true. It comes up, how will you handle it?
Well,
he won't be involved.
Yeah, I'll recuse myself if it is.
If there's a conflict, he won't be involved. Yeah, I wouldn't want that, and he won't want it.
That did not assuage the concerns of Don Fox. He was the top lawyer at the Office of Government Ethics during the George W. Bush and Obama administrations.
Musk seems to be in a position with the White House's consent that he can just change hats by the hour as it suits him.
The White House says Musk will file a confidential disclosure of his financial interests with the Office of Government Ethics by the end of next month and has been briefed on ethics requirements. As a special government employee, a temporary role, he doesn't have to divest from his businesses, but he is supposed to recuse himself when necessary. Fox says there's little indication the normal process to avoid conflicts is being followed.
The thing that the public should be concerned about is, we don't know. Is he looking after our interests as taxpayers and citizens, or is he looking after his own business interests?
These questions about Musk come up as Trump just fired the director of the Office of Government Ethics, along with other watchdogs. Richard Brefault specializes in government ethics at Columbia Law School and describes Musk as basically a walking conflict of interest.
Whatever the guardrails, and I guess that phrase guardrails has been used a lot, but whatever the guardrails are there in terms of preventing public officials from engaging in self-dealing, enforcement seems to be gone.
A White House official not authorized to speak about this publicly dismissed the criticisms as partisan, saying there is no concern in the White House about whether Musk will follow strict ethics rules. Tamara Keith, NPR News.
Maxim Butkevich was not part of the Ukrainian military when Russia launched its full-scale invasion 3 years ago. In fact, Butkevich was a journalist and an activist, and those in his circles would have called him a pacifist and an anti-militarist. Still, compelled by the notion that sometimes the only way to stop violent crime in huge proportions is to use force, he volunteered and became a commander in Ukraine's armed forces. Butkevich was captured by the Russian army in the summer of 2022 in eastern Ukraine after his platoon became surrounded.
We've lost communication, and then the first person who appeared on our radios was a soldier from a neighboring battalion who said that the circle isn't closed yet, and if we go by landmarks, he will indicate we'll get out together with him. Basically, he was captured already by Russians, so he lured us onto Russian positions, and we couldn't even run or hide because it was an open field.
Butkevich told me about his difficult first months, the physical pain such as beatings and torture.
There was an ideological moment. A Russian military officer who's done that, as he said, he was teaching us Ukrainian history by reciting Vladimir Putin's address to the nation. Then he forced us to repeat it. And if any of my POWs had a slip of tongue or paused, I was beaten with a wooden stick. I say nowadays that I have a scar from that moment, so that Putin's version of Ukrainian history is literally written on my skin.
Butkevich was eventually charged and sentenced to 13 years in prison for crimes against civilians in Ukraine's Russian-occupied East, charges he denied and appealed but lost. Ultimately, he would spend over 2 years in captivity before he was released in October of last year as part of a prisoner swap. Speaking to me from NPR HQ in Washington, D.C., Butkevich tells me that Russian captivity may have done many things to him, but what it did not do was change his mind about what Ukraine needs to do to ensure its success once the war is over.
What was really important to understand what is the main difference between us and those who attacked us and those who are killing us? And the main value is people, human beings. and their rights and their plight and their freedom and what they feel like and how they live. And the state is just a tool, or should be just a tool. I mean, this is, sounds like a very banal thing, but when you look at Russia, and I've seen it from inside, this is just the opposite, because people are disposable material, are valued only when they serve the state. And of course, the state is embodied in national leader. So it's totally authoritarian structure where people don't really mean anything.
So then with Ukraine following the end of the war, when it happens, I'm sure many people will want Ukraine to open up to investment to get the economy up and running again. Is there a way to do that and still put, as you desire, human rights, civil liberties, to make that the core values of a post-war Ukraine?
Ukraine will need to open up to investment, but I really believe that we should do that with very clear safeguards when it comes to the consequences to people. I think that human rights, and specifically labor rights, should be not only observed and respected, but developed, and this should be a precondition to any investment. And also, I think that basic, most important services should be accessible for everyone. I mean medicine, and I mean education, especially for younger generation.
But the thing is, so, you know, I know that Ukraine has had a problem in the past with corruption and oligarchs, the very rich business leaders that also have political power. So how do you square trying to open up the country for investment?
Yes, it is an endemic problem for Ukraine, for Ukrainian society. But at the same time, there's never been such a huge demand on dealing with it, and a demand for social justice, in a way, as now. Also, not because it is desirable, but because all the sacrifices Ukrainian people have made. So the picture looks a little bit different now than in previous discussions. And I think now we have a potential to deal with the most acute issues. I mean, although, of course, I'm not that naive to say that it will just disappear in a matter of days or weeks or months. It is a process, but it is a process of dealing with it.
When it comes to a post-war Ukraine with expanded social programs, possibly labor reform, a bigger role in government, is that concerning at all, given that Ukraine used to be part of the Soviet Union? Is there a way to square those two things?
Well, you know, Soviet Union legacy is a damaging one when it comes to the social interests and areas of social life, because like labor rights and unions and social services are regarded and treated as a paternalistic approach to the state. And the Soviet Union talked so much about social security of people and social rights to be enforced, that quite often when we talk about them now, it has this Soviet legacy air about them. But I believe that with more than 30 years passed since collapse of Soviet Union, these things are reinvented, especially by younger generations, so we'll be able to do it differently.
President Trump has long said that he could end the war in Ukraine. How likely do you think that is to happen?
Well, quite a lot of people say that, of course, in the worst case scenario, he can end war by cutting off aid to Ukraine, but basically that will be end of war by defeat of Ukraine. But I don't think it will actually end the war. I believe that really President Trump or whoever is in charge can help to end war, but in a different manner, to provide the support to Ukraine, which is so critical that it will be too expensive and too damaging for Russian empire in making to continue this war. I see it as the only way really to end it.
That is Maxim Butkevich, Ukrainian journalist, activist, and former Russian POW. Maxim, thank you very much for your story.
Thank you very much.
This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Andrew Scott. He first became known in the U.S. as the Hot Priest because of his role in Fleabag. Now he's nominated for a SAG Award for his starring role in the Netflix series Ripley, adapted from the novel The Talented Mr. Ripley. He won a National Society of Film Critics Award for his performance in All of Us Strangers. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. In Israel, authorities say a body returned by Hamas, a hostage, is not who the militants claimed it to be.
Among the four bodies handed over yesterday were supposed to be those of two young boys and their mother, but after forensic testing, Israeli officials said the mother's remains were not among the bodies of the returned hostages.
NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi has been following events. Hadil, good morning.
Good morning.
I just have to ask, what happened?
Well, we know that Hamas was supposed to return the bodies of Shiri Bibas. She was 32 when she was kidnapped. Her two young sons, Ariel, who was 4 at the time, and Kfir, who was just 9 months old. Hamas also said they returned Oded Lifshitz, who was 83. And then later in the day, Israeli officials said that forensic testing positively identified the bodies of Lifshitz and the two young boys. But the body that was supposed to be the kid's mother was what they said, quote, an anonymous, unidentified body. The Israeli military said that that body didn't even belong to any known hostage. Now, you have to understand, the Bibas family really became the symbol of Israeli pain after the attacks of October 7th, you know, the plight of the hostages. The boys were just so young. So the news did come as a shock to the country. And then in a statement today, Hamas acknowledged there could have been an error and the remains thought to be Shiri Bibas's could have been mixed with the remains of a Palestinian who was staying in the location where the hostages were being kept. Hamas is asking Israel to return the remains of that Palestinian.
Each of these hostage returns, whether the people are living or dead, has been horrifying in one way or another and dismaying to people in Israel. So what does all this mean for the next steps, another hostage exchange and the next phase of the peace talks?
Yeah, so that next hostage exchange is supposed to happen tomorrow. And I have to say, you know, like the whole ceasefire has been so precarious. Just last week, there was a chance the deal was going to just fall all apart when Hamas alleged Israel committed violations, Israel denied them. But it also looks like both sides want to get this done, especially now with pressure from the United States. So NPR talked to an Israeli official who's familiar with the matter, but they weren't authorized to speak publicly. And we were told that Israel is actually inclined to move ahead with Saturday's prisoner exchange. They said Israel just doesn't want to jeopardize the release of the Israeli hostages this weekend. But then the official also said Israel is going to take advantage that Shiri Bibas's body wasn't returned as a point of negotiation to ask for more hostage releases going forward.
Hadil, what is this news of explosions in Tel Aviv in Israel that has come out in the same 24-hour period as the hostage exchange of the bodies returned?
That's right. So three buses exploded in a suburb called Bat Yam. It's just south of Tel Aviv. Luckily, no injuries were reported. The police said the buses were empty. They had just finished their routes. They were parked in lots around the city. Israeli police said it found explosives on two other buses, which didn't detonate. The bombs were the same type as those that had exploded, and bomb squads were able to defuse them. No group claimed responsibility, but right away, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office ordered the military to step up its incursions in the occupied West Bank. The military has escalated its airstrikes and raids there since the beginning of the ceasefire, especially around the city of Jenin. Thousands of Palestinians have been displaced from their homes because of these attacks, and Israel says the operations are trying to root out militants.
NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi, thanks for your reporting. Really appreciate it, as always.
You're welcome, Steve.
It's time again for StoryCorps. This week we have a visit with the widow of comedian and civil rights activist Dick Gregory. After his death in 2017, Lillian Gregory developed Alzheimer's. Two of their 10 children, Ayanna and Paula, sat down with their mom to help her remember her life.
Mom, what was the thing that you called Dad, the nickname you had?
Oh, yeah, I know that nickname. My damn fine cat.
Come on now.
MDFC, right?
Yes.
Oh, God.
And how did I meet him?
It was in Chicago.
Okay, right, because he was a comedian.
Yes, indeed. Can I say something, Mama?
Yeah.
You did not know that Dad was going to move so deeply into the civil rights movement. But the beauty is that you said, wherever you go, I'm going with you.
Okay. You were arrested many times. And once you were arrested, pregnant with twins.
Was I? Mm-hmm.
You and Pam?
Mm-hmm. You stayed in jail for nearly 2 weeks.
Also, you always say that you can't believe how much Dad relied on you.
Right. Because anybody asked him about anything, he would say, call Will. That was his part of my life. And I loved every minute of it.
One of my favorite memories of what I call growing up Gregory was I came home from college in 1987, but I was pregnant with Shayla. So I knew I had to tell you and Dad. I remember telling you first, and you were like, oh my God, how did that happen?
Oh, God, I actually said that?
Yes. So you were kind of a wreck. Then you were like, oh gosh, you have to tell your father. So I said, Dad, I'm pregnant. And he was like, shoot, that's all you had to tell me? Just don't bring any cats up in this house. Because he knew you were afraid of cats.
Oh, heavily, heavily afraid of cats. Something about that meow.
Yep. Looking back, Dad was just so cool in his way of showing how much he loved us.
Sometimes I think about Dad and I just want to boo-hoo with happiness. I miss him dearly, dearly, but I just know he's in God's hands.
I remember looking at Dad, this is maybe an hour before he died, and Dad can do this wink that only he can do.
Only he could do.
And it just said to me, hey, the show might be over, but I'm not.
But I'm not. Oh, what a precious memory. Sometimes I wake up at night and I will think about my life. And, you know, the first thing I do is put my hands together and say, thank you, Heavenly Father, for my life, my children, my husband, and that's all I see in it. Overall, I would not give anything for it. Just not anything, really.
Lillian Gregory, Paula Sinek, and Ayanna Gregory. Their interview is part of the StoryCorps Brightness in Black Project at the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Subaru, who, along with its retailers, is partnering with Operation Warm to provide more than 130,000 children in need with brand new necessities like coats, shoes, and socks. Subaru, more than a car company. And from Dignity Memorial, pre-planning a celebration of life can allow more time to focus on life's little moments. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to professionalism and compassion in every detail. More at dignitymemorial.com.
This is NPR News.
The Trump administration's rhetoric on expansion has been pretty unpopular among Greenlandic citizens.
We will never surrender to anyone.
But there are some outliers.
From the first term, I was supporting him here in Greenland.
I'm Juana Summers in Greenland's capital with diverging views on Trump's ambitions here. On All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. President Trump continues to pressure Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky to negotiate an end to Russia's war with Kyiv. NPR's Greg Myrie says Trump's special envoy to Russia and Ukraine, Keith Kellogg, met with Zelensky yesterday in Kyiv.
In his nightly address, Zelensky said the meeting with Kellogg, quote, restores hope. Perhaps the tone in the private discussion was a little less harsh than what we're hearing publicly. Zelensky stressed the need for security guarantees to make sure Russia can never attack again. So talks seemed cordial, but not clear if they resolved any key issues.
French President Emmanuel Macron is due at the White House on Monday to discuss the war in Ukraine with President Trump. The Trump administration says it's looking into the cost overruns and delays with California's high-speed rail project linking Los Angeles and San Francisco.
This is going to help determine whether billions of dollars in taxpayer money should remain committed to California's high-speed rail. And we're going to look at whether California high-speed rail has actually complied with the agreements that they've signed with the federal government.
That's Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, who says the 17-year project has yet to produce any finished rail. The state says construction continues on more than 170 miles of the project. This is NPR News. There's a court hearing today in New York for the man charged with killing the CEO of United Healthcare outside a hotel in Midtown Manhattan back in December. Luigi Mangione is to appear on state charges of murder and terrorism. He's also facing separate federal charges that carry a possible death sentence. Elon Musk is downplaying a report in the Financial Times that a Japanese investment group wants Tesla to invest in Nissan now that Nissan's merger talks with Honda have collapsed. Late last year, Nissan announced plans to eliminate 9,000 jobs worldwide. A new study looks at why many people crave sugar, even when they're full. Here's NPR's Emily Kwong.
When you're out to eat and the server comes by and says, hey, you got any room for dessert? Where does that voice inside that says, yes, I will take a slice of cake, come from? A study in the journal Science offers a new clue. Henning Fenzelau of the Max Planck Institute fed mice to the point of fullness and then gave them sugar. His team noticed that the same neurons which signaled that the mice were full also released naturally occurring opiates, which triggered a feeling of reward. His team then found the same neural pathway in humans.
Because sugar is so easy to metabolize, its consumption beyond energy needs is favorable for animals.
The team ultimately hopes this research can help create better weight loss drugs. For NPR News, I'm Emily Kwong.
I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Your Part-Time Controller, the nonprofit accounting specialists, providing financial management services to support stronger nonprofits who make the world a better place. Learn more at yptc.com/NPR. From Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates, all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. We have a clearer picture this morning of how the Trump administration is using the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba.
The United States recently sent a group of migrants to the base. Now they've been sent away on the way to their eventual destination, their home country of Venezuela.
And we've learned some information about them along the way. So let's go to NPR immigration correspondent Sergio Martinez Beltran. Sergio, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
What do you know about this flight?
Well, the Trump administration announced yesterday that 177 Venezuelans who had been in Guantanamo Bay for a couple of weeks were removed to Honduras. That's all but one of the migrants who'd been detained there. Honduras was sort of a layover for them. The Venezuelan government met them later and flew them back home, and the migrants landed in Venezuela last night around 10 p.m. local time.
Okay, so United States, Guantanamo, Honduras, Venezuela, zigzagging around the Caribbean and surrounding areas. So I want to figure out what we've learned here. What do you know about who these people are or were?
So the administration had said, Steve, everyone sent to Guantanamo were hardened criminals and that many were members of Tren de Aragua, the Venezuelan gang. But now we know that's not true. In court documents released because of a lawsuit by the ACLU, the Trump administration admitted that nearly 30% of the detainees were considered, quote, low-threat illegal aliens. Many of the mothers of the detainees had been pushing back against that narrative. One of them is Joanna Roldan. Her son, Joiner Purroy Roldan, had been accused of being a member of Tren de Aragua.
Y yo sé que mi hijo no cometió ningún delito y no merece pasar por todo lo que ha pasado, ¿sabes?
I know my son has not committed a crime, she says, and he doesn't deserve to go through all of this just for trying to have a better future. And I should say, Steve, NPR didn't find any criminal record for Purroy Roldan, and it appears at least a third of the people with him in Guantanamo had not committed crimes.
Okay, so I guess some of them were accused of crimes. Some of them were not accused of crimes other than entering the United States illegally, and they went to Guantanamo. Here's my next question. If they sent people to Guantanamo briefly, only to send them onward to other places, it's a way station, it's a transfer point. Well, what's the point?
That's a good question. The administration knows that sending migrants to Guantanamo is very costly and very complicated logistically, but it's clear many of these migrants were used as part of a public relations operation by the White House. Most, if not all, of the people they sent to Guantanamo had already been in detention during the Biden administration, so these were not new arrestees. And when they were put on a plane, there were cameras, and those visuals were published across the world. It also tells us that Guantanamo will likely be a temporary detention facility that will be used to house migrants from countries where deportations might be more challenging.
Okay, so they're sending a signal either to the U.S. public or to future migrants about what they want to do to people who come to the United States. Another question now, Sergio. What was the lawsuit that you mentioned earlier?
Yeah, that lawsuit was filed by the ACLU because for a few weeks, no one knew where these migrants were. The family members had stopped hearing from their loved ones, and they assumed they had been transferred to Guantanamo, but the government never told them. And so the ACLU was alleging that the migrants did not have access to telephones to call attorneys or family members. But despite this new development of removing people from Guantanamo, the ACLU says the lawsuit continues. Last night, I talked with the lead ACLU attorney on this case. He told me the removal of all detainees won't stop the lawsuit unless the Trump administration tells the court they will not transfer anyone else to Guantanamo.
NPR Sergio Martinez Beltran, thanks for your reporting. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
The Famine Early Warning Systems Network, or FuseNet, is used around the world to predict and respond to food crises. Now it's gone dark because of Trump administration spending cuts. Here's reporter Gabriel Spitzer.
FuseNet was just about to turn 40 this year. It was born in 1985 in the wake of massive famines in Africa, especially in Ethiopia, where nearly 1 million deaths shocked the world and inspired the charity single We Are the World. Under President Reagan, the U.S. responded to the crisis by creating a system to predict famine before it happens. Dave Harden oversaw FuseNet during the Obama administration, including another dark period for Ethiopia. In 2016, FuseNet forecast a major drought there and warned the risk of famine was high.
So we were able to send a disaster assistance response team to Ethiopia in advance and pre-position food and other aid. Dramatically different than what you had in the mid-80s, where millions of people died. In 2016 in Ethiopia, nobody died.
FuseNet combines NASA satellite imagery with climate data and information about conditions on the ground, producing detailed maps showing the risk of famine in different places. The information is widely used by governments, aid groups, and the UN. But since late January, the USAID-funded website where those maps normally appear has been offline.
It's like having a truck full of grain, but taking the steering wheel away.
Andrew Natsios is a professor at the Bush School at Texas A&M. He ran USAID during the George W. Bush administration.
The FUSE maps are the steering wheel for the aid programs.
Natsios' old boss was a noted supporter of FuseNet. President Bush would reportedly ask to see the color-coded maps every month to stay ahead of food crises. Natsios says the early warning system costs a pittance compared with the value it creates.
I don't know what they're thinking. We spend $15 billion a year on humanitarian assistance. A lot of that is food. The notion that we can't have a couple of million dollars spent on analyzing the areas of the world that we should be sending the food doesn't make any sense to me. It's silly.
A lot of food assistance is now on hold following President Trump's dismantling of USAID. Emergency aid is supposed to be exempt from the freeze, though humanitarian groups say much of the food still isn't flowing. The State Department did not respond to NPR's request for comment. Alex Duvall is a professor at Tufts University and head of the school's World Peace Foundation, which supports research on justice and nonviolence. He says even if the aid is released, getting it to the right place depends on FuseNet.
This is the key intelligence system of the global humanitarian system, and that prop has just been knocked out from one day to the next by the Trump administration for no good reason.
Experts say FuseNet was far from perfect. In 2020, it largely missed signs of a famine in South Sudan. Last year, FuseNet issued a famine alert for the Gaza Strip, which it then retracted under criticism from the U.S. ambassador to Israel. Still, Duvall says overall, FuseNet has a good record of getting it right. And it's hard to make foreign assistance less wasteful and more efficient if you don't have a picture of where the needs are. For NPR News, I'm Gabriel Spitzer.
Later today on All Things Considered, how the frontrunner to be Germany's next chancellor says he plans to restore the country's economic and military might. Listen on your smartphone, smart speaker, or your radio, which can be pretty smart too. This is NPR News.
President Trump's efforts to cut the federal government are being challenged in courts across the country. How are judges ruling? Our weekly roundtable next time, here and now.
Appointments get canceled, plans fall through, but NPR is always there with news you can trust live at the top of every hour. Listen on your phone at this station's website or NPR.org.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. The James Bond movies have been shaken, not stirred. The Bond movies were controlled by a British family, the Broccolis. Amazon bought a stake a few years ago, but the Broccolis kept final say over who got to play Bond and scripts and stunts. Until now, Amazon MGM Studios took creative control. On social media, Amazon's Jeff Bezos asked who should play the next James Bond.
I suggest Inskeep, Steve Inskeep.
That's fine with me, M. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on thinkorswim. Learn more at Schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. President Trump's administration has brought its firings to FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the people who help local authorities in disasters.
In addition to the firings, people involved tell NPR that FEMA is cutting back on its work to make homes and buildings safer before a disaster. This is also one of the agencies the president has talked of eliminating.
Lauren Sommer with NPR's Climate Desk is covering this story. Lauren, good morning.
Good morning.
How many people were fired?
So it's more than 200 employees. That's what the Department of Homeland Security told me, and they oversee FEMA. These were workers on probationary status, which basically means they were within 1 year of taking the job. But, you know, I spoke to people that had been at the agency more than a decade, and they were only on probationary status because they accepted a promotion for a new job. You know, one told me the firings were like doing surgery with a chainsaw instead of a scalpel.
Okay, so 200 firings, but it is an agency with thousands. So how would this affect their response in a disaster?
Right, yeah. So when disasters happen, it's really all hands on deck at FEMA. They put hundreds of people on the ground to connect disaster victims and, you know, enroll them for financial assistance. You know, that's for things like renting a place to live or rebuilding long term. Those FEMA staff come from every part of FEMA. And I talked to Michael Cohn, who was FEMA's chief of staff under the Biden administration, and he says the agency was already understaffed.
We've been behind at FEMA as far as our recruiting goals. And now to let go a whole year's worth of people who have been hired is only going to put the agency in jeopardy.
Last year, during Hurricane Helene, FEMA had to use employees from other federal agencies to fill the gap because the need was so great from disaster survivors.
Although, didn't the president suggest that FEMA wasn't necessary when he was talking during the Los Angeles fires?
Yeah, he said disaster recovery is better left to the states, and he's actually creating a council that will review and potentially overhaul FEMA. You know, local and state governments actually already run disaster recovery, and they request that FEMA come in. But aspects of FEMA's work are already changing because, you know, one thing the agency does is help develop building codes. These are the construction standards that help homes survive floods and hurricane winds. FEMA experts had already written recommendations about how to strengthen those codes. They were submitted to the International Code Council, which is an association that updates the codes every 3 years, and then local and state governments adopt them. But FEMA has asked for its name to be taken off those recommendations. According to people who are involved with that work and spoke with me, they want to remain anonymous over concerns about retribution from the Trump administration. And FEMA did not respond to our questions about why they made this request.
This is really interesting reporting you have here, and I want to talk about this. There is a wider debate over building requirements. There are even liberals and progressives, as well as conservatives, who think we've made it too hard to build stuff and that it's bad for society. But I assume you're talking here about relatively narrow recommendations about how to make your house or your building survive a disaster.
Yeah. These are recommendations that come out of actual disasters, you know, seeing what hasn't worked. It's things like maybe raising up a house a little bit so floodwaters don't come in. And research really shows they add about 1-2% of the construction costs, but they've saved billions of dollars in damage that would have happened otherwise.
NPR's Lauren Sommer from our climate desk. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Our theme music was inspired by B.J. Lederman. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin.
Consumers have the travel bug again.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Progressive Insurance. On the road and at home, customers can simplify their insurance needs and protect what's important by bundling home and auto with Progressive Insurance. Learn more about Progressive and bundling at progressive.com.
From Marketplace, I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. Shares of Booking Holdings are popping this morning. Booking Holdings is the company behind Booking.com, Priceline, Kayak, a bunch of other travel and leisure sites. The company announced yesterday the profits were up almost 50% last quarter compared to a year earlier. Lots of companies in the travel industry are reporting better profit margins, which is another way of saying that consumers are paying more. Marketplace's Nova Sappho is here with the details. Hi, Nova.
Good morning, Sabri.
So Booking's doing well. What do we know about how other travel companies are doing?
Well, consumers are paying more everywhere. It's been pretty much the same story throughout the travel industry. We've heard from Airbnb, Expedia, all reporting strong sales. Overseas travel is doing particularly well. Travel in Europe, the Asia-Pacific region, Booking saw revenue up 14% compared to a year ago. Expedia previously reported a 10% increase. Airbnb is up 12%. And all of this because households with $100,000 or more in income, which make up a vast majority of travelers, are still doing well in this economy, Sabri, and they want to travel.
How are airlines doing?
Well, we've heard from all the major U.S. carriers and European ones, and they're predicting better results this year compared to last. And that's because of both the strong demand out there and also limited capacity. Now, that's an additional issue over at the airlines. They don't have enough planes. That's not changing anytime soon. Both Airbus and Boeing are behind in their deliveries. The airlines also have been generally more disciplined about increasing capacity this year compared to last. Last year, carriers found themselves with just too many seats to sell, and all of a sudden they were in a price war, and that hurt their profits. Not this time, and that means higher ticket prices. People are feeling that already. By one estimate, tickets sold through travel agencies were up 17% this year compared to last. That was around December. So that's a huge increase, Sabri.
All right, Marketplace's Nova Sappho, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All right, let's do the numbers. The Dow is down 360 points. That is 0.8%. The S&P 500 is down 0.6%. The NASDAQ is down 0.6%. The yield on the 10-year Treasury is 4.492%. And consumer sentiment sank this month compared to January, according to the University of Michigan's Consumer Sentiment Survey. More than half of consumers expect the unemployment rate to rise over the next year, and expectations of inflation also rose. People now believe inflation will be at 3.5% over the next 5 to 10 years. That's the highest expectation in decades.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Schwab. Schwab offers investors choices like full-service wealth management, self-directed investing options, and trading on thinkorswim. More at schwab.com. And by Sony Pictures Classics, presenting I'm Still Here, starring Fernanda Torres. A woman reinvents herself after suffering an injustice, now playing select cities.
You can gamble at convenience stores. You can gamble on your smartphone, online, on sports, on really anything at this point. You can credit or blame Massachusetts for that. Scratch and Win is a new podcast from Boston-based GBH News about how we got to this place of ubiquitous gaming/gambling. The host is Ian Koss, and he spoke with my colleague David Brancaccio.
Sounds like the Bay State was, what should we call it, a cauldron of innovation when it comes to gambling and lotteries?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. A really important thing to understand is that early on when the state lotteries got rolling in the 60s and 70s, these were incredibly conservative agencies. They were terrified of, you know, breaking the public's trust, of, you know, getting infiltrated by the mob. So they did not try a lot of new things. What happens in Massachusetts is that the state lottery winds up in the hands of this state treasurer who was kind of a vaudeville guy. He'd literally grown up the son of a vaudeville stagehand. He loved to sing. He had this sort of showman personality. The treasurer, Bob Crane, singing at a nursing home back in the 1970s. He had this whole group called the Treasury Notes that used to go around and perform. You can see how the culture in Massachusetts around innovation, experimentation, and really entertainment was very different from the start.
All right. We think of like drawing ping pong balls in a random
drawing when you think of the lottery. But, of course, another part of it is the scratch ticket.
Scratch tickets are the bread and butter game of all state lotteries. That's not just Massachusetts. It's something like two-thirds of all lottery sales, and that's a $100 billion industry, if you want to call it an industry. And scratch tickets start in Massachusetts. It really is the first and most important of the innovations that happened here. And I spent some time at a convenience store in Quincy, Mass. I met this man who's a mechanic who did not want to share his name, but I would come there every day on his lunch break and spend literally hundreds of dollars. So what are you playing right now?
I play at $50 every day.
Have you won yet?
Right there. So far I already spent $300 on the bucket. There's nothing.
So why do you keep playing?
I'm dreaming to get that big one.
Yeah.
So I can retire. I'm 75 years old.
Yeah.
I don't have a money in retirement. Too late to start now because I already spent so much money. So maybe this one, but end up getting broke and broke.
And that's really, I mean, the scratch ticket, if you think about it, that is, you know, instant gambling anywhere, anytime, in the palm of your hand, started in 1974 in Massachusetts.
Yeah, instant gratification. And how does that vignette help us understand where we are today nationwide?
Lotteries, they kind of did the political work and a lot of the cultural work of bringing gambling out of the shadows of society and into the open. You know, back in the 60s, gambling was something you associated either with Las Vegas or the mob. And lotteries, by taking this thing that was vice, that was in the shadows, putting the state's stamp of approval on it, it really brings it out into the open. And that's what sets the stage for casino expansion in the 1990s, for states to get into sports betting, and really everything that we're living in today.
Ian Koss is the host of Scratch and Win, a podcast from GBH News. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Ian, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Our executive producer is Kelly Silvera. Our digital producer is Dylan Miettinen. Our engineers are Brian Allison and John Brewington. And I'm Sabri Benishore with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.